This is a short story called The Urge Purged. There was a time when Jeff Chalkley, a senior buyer at Homebase in Chiswick, would have been the last person I would have imagined accused of a sexually aggravated breach of the peace. But sadly, not now. My minor, certainly not actionable, involvement in Jeff's story began with a phone call from him just as I was about to throw myself off a 90-metre crane. Jeff asked to meet, and when I landed, I breathlessly agreed. On the following Friday evening, I met Jeff, a man who, up until then, hadn't shown the slightest interest in base jumping, body surfing, or zorbing, at the Sherlock Holmes pub on Baker Street. He was sitting ramrod straight in the bay window, sipping orange juice and reading a copy of the Tablet. I got myself a pint of nutty brown Iyengar brow, slung my rucksack over the back of a chair and dazzled Jeff with a grin. "What's up?" I asked brightly. Jeff looked like I'd just farted in church. So I composed myself and listened to what he had to say. "Now look here, Spencer, I want to talk to you about something rather personal. Fact is, I'm about to celebrate my 20th wedding anniversary, and despite that, my wife and I still get on very well. However, it's become clear over the long years that my interest in the more physical side of our marriage is not reciprocated by my wife." You've got some foam on the end of your nose. Ta. "Now, I'm not going to go into details, but I'm having a certain medical procedure done next week to make sure I don't jeopardize my marriage by acting the goat every time I have a tear, Maria. You know Gemma in the office? I am so fed up with coming in every morning, casting an eye over the latest little nothing she's not wearing, and pratfalling over the yucca. It's not dignified for a man of my age. So, something must be done. And that, my sunstroked friend, is where you come in." Jeff explained that the procedure he was going to have, libido dampening, was a half-hour walk-in job at a private clinic in Mayfair. And all I had to do was accompany him there and back in case he had a fit of the screaming abdabs. For that, he'd sponsor me to jump off Beachy Head, which was very generous of him. We shook hands, and Jeff finished his orange juice, brooding darkly. If this works, little Gemma could be packed into her slacks like two scoops of vanilla ice cream, for all I care. I'll be about as up for it as Peter Tatchell. "Drink up. I'm seeing suppliers at 2. Fast forward to 1 week later, and I'm standing outside the Wimpole Hair Loss Clinic in Mayfair with Jeff, I'm wondering out loud whether we'd got the right place. Jeff spluttered derision. "You don't really think these clinics treat hair loss, do you? What are you, nuts? There are bald guys everywhere. If there was a cure, why would there be bald guys? Cure, no bald guys. Bald guys, no cure. Stands to reason." Come on, it's starting to rain. We crossed the street to the sort of building you expect Harley Street doctors to practice from, and Jeff buzzed us in. After signing at reception, we chilled to whale song in a tranquil waiting room, and Jeff gave his credit card details to an incredibly fit nurse. Before long, a Dr. Mackey and his nursing assistant Regina swept through the door, shook our hands, and led us from the waiting room down a long, empty corridor it would have been great to skateboard down, and then into a rickety lift which ascended 4 or 5 floors. Once there, Jeff disappeared into a side room, while I was taken to the operating theatre itself. I've never been in such a place. The room was mostly empty space, but in the center was a raised dais and a floodlit operating table, straight out of the movies. Straddling the table were 3 long metal legs, each almost 18 feet long, joined at the apex so they formed a tripod, legs splayed around the table. The legs supported a shining metal globe about a foot and a half in diameter, and numerous insulated cables looped from connectors on the legs to points on the walls. Above us, a glass awning revealed the night sky, racked with lightning and pelting rain. Jeff soon appeared through a door just behind me, this time wearing nothing but a white hospital gown tied loosely behind him, his bum cheeks peering out of a gap in the back, and a bizarre metal helmet on his head. He nudged me and managed a nervous laugh. Bit rum, eh? Hope they know what they're doing. Too right, I thought, thinking of my first calamitous base jump and the 6 months I'd spent in a halo brace. I leant over to the doctor. This is safe, isn't it? Dr. Mackey was indignant. Of course it is, he snapped, slapping my hands away from the computer. So, what sort of people do you get in here for, what's it called again? Libido dampening? The doctor flicked virtual windows across the screen. Oh, archbishops, film censors, Cliff, obviously. Most are private clients. Others are sent here under court orders, all sorts, really. Jeff, by this stage, was being helped onto the operating table by the bewitching nurse Regina and cables screwed into the top of the helmet he was wearing. The whole thing seemed extremely dodgy to me, but if Jeff wanted to take an extended cold shower by plugging himself into the mains, that was his business. He'd always struck me as the sort of person who thought excitement was a Hornby Limited Edition Flying Scotsman. I sat on a stool behind the lead-lined screen with Dr. Mackey and Regina and watched as the procedure began. Nothing happened for a few seconds. And then, subtly, a deep rumble grew around us, a bit like when the THX kicks in at the Odeon, growing in strength until my fillings started to hurt. After a minute of that, the metal globe at the top of the tripod started spitting and crackling, and then, as Morticia and Gomez conferred, a series of terrifying bangs rang out from the top of the structure, and several long, snaking tendrils of electricity probed outwards, leaping point to point. Above us, the night sky was again momentarily lit up, and the glass rattled precipitously. The rumbling grew ever more insistent, but Jeff remained still as the probing tendrils of electricity played around him. The sense of power building up around us was incredible, but just as Mackie indicated to Regina to initiate phase two, there was an almighty crash above us, and a bolt of white lightning lanced out of the night sky and connected with the metal globe above Jeff. The result was literally electrifying. A shower of glowing sparks exploded in an arc above the table, and every one of the PowerPoints around the room burst into flames. I reared backwards off my stool and banged my head on the desk behind me, but managed to haul myself up in time to catch sight of all hell breaking loose before me. Jeff's prone form lay strobe-lit on the table. He was convulsing from his feet all the way up through his body to the tips of his fingers, his arms raised involuntarily in front of him and shaking terribly. His hair was standing on end, and with his head thrown back and his face locked in a terrible rictus, the man was screaming pitifully. It was horrible to witness. Another lightning bolt lashed out of the sky, and just as somewhere Mackie yelled, "Cut the power!" there was another ear-splitting crash, and everything went dark. I can't remember who started shouting first. It was like when I tried freestyle motocross for the first time and drove straight into a crowd of spectators. Despite all of us being in a state of shock, we lunged out from behind the screen and raced to help Jeff. The operating table had collapsed beneath the smoking legs of the tripod. The metal globe was in bits all across the floor, and sparking power cables were draped everywhere. But Regina wriggled her slight frame between the criss-crossed legs of the tripod and carefully slid Jeff out to a clear space on the floor. "Oh, my," moaned Jeff. "Mr. Chalkley, don't move. You may have broken something." Sweet Jesus. We crowded around, eager to help. It's all right, mate. Everything's going to be just fine. Jeff clasped the girl's arm and sat up, smiling oddly. He stared round at us all and took a long, shuddering breath. Then he looked into Regina's eyes, placed a hand on her left breast, and pulled the startled girl into a lingering kiss. "Is it hot in here?" asked Jeff. "Or is it just you?" That was how it began. And I wish to God we'd never gone near the frigging Wimpole hair loss clinic, or I'd at least tried harder to talk Jeff out of his crazy plan. The following weeks brought repeated evidence of Jeff's brand new T-Rex libido. Jeff frightening sheep on Bodmin Moor. Jeff arrested in car parks at the dead of night. Jeff bursting into the office and leaping on poor Gemma. After 1 3-day bender, he returned home, was made about as welcome as a skunk at a garden party by his wife, and eventually disappeared again to a solitary life of hostels and escort agencies. I spent the rest of that summer inside Second Life. I felt dreadfully responsible for what had happened. And 3 weeks after the event, I was still having dreams in which I jumped off the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur and saw Jeff falling past me without a parachute, crying, "Help me, Spencer, help me!" I would wake up yelling and thinking that as anxiety dreams went, I preferred the one in the trash compactor with Princess Leia. And then I would go back to sleep and hope that a new day would see life return to normal. It never did. Jeff's wife, Margaret, wanted him to go to Sex Addicts Anonymous, wanted him to write his biography, wanted to sue the backside off the Wimpole Hair Loss Clinic, and in her most despairing moments, wanted him to join the First Earth Battalion as part of their non-lethal weapons division and help develop the gay bomb. The apparatus that had done this to her husband could surely be adapted to make enemy invaders sexually irresistible to each other. And she mooted the idea in the press to no avail. Finally, there was Jeff, who was no looker. And the accident hadn't done anything to change his Eeyore-ish manner or transform him overnight into a cult figure. He was a middle-aged man at the mercy of a terrible compulsion. And ultimately, the zipper proved his undoing. Why should a man suffer for trying to treat his wife with respect? Love is more than proportionate drives. I hope this testimony will go some way to explaining why Jeff was in that hostel, simulating sex with a bicycle, and why his freedom should not be curtailed. I believe that if he took up a variety of extreme sports, he would be so exhausted by the end of the day, he'd be barely capable of a high five, let alone the missionary position. As for myself, I come away from this sorry tale with new insight into the hopeless plight facing bald men, a determination to accrue the necessary number of dives for my international skydiving license, and above all, compassion for a man who is living proof that sex puts men in ridiculous positions. Thank you very much.